I know what you're all thinking is that after the talk last night and so on, what you all want no more Mickey Mouse fairy stories and lots of Pali terminology and some hardcore analysis of meditation states. That's what you want, isn't it? Okay, so don't worry, I'll give you what you want tonight, okay? Never complain that I don't care. So tonight I'm going to throw around a bit of terminology, Pali terms, and some bit more detailed description of the stages of meditation. If you don't like Pali, bad luck. Okay, so we've been developing metta meditation. We've talked about metta for oneself, for a loved person, and for a neutral person. Tonight I'm going to talk about developing metta for a disliked person and how to develop that further, and particularly how to develop that to enter jhana. And to do that, I'm going to have to give a bit more description and background about what jhana is and how we've actually been developing that or moving towards that during this whole time. Now, when we talk about jhanas, just as a bit of a general background, the jhanas are a set of four states of consciousness the Buddha called the higher mind, adhicitta. And these four jhanas, four states of samadhi, are defined as the right samadhi of the Eightfold Path. So I probably need to define what samadhi is here. Samadhi means something like coalescence. They usually translate samadhi as concentration. But samadhi doesn't have the kind of the forcing aspect of concentration. But samadhi more means where everything sort of comes together with a sense of composure and coalescence of things. So one of the factors, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, right samadhi, literally where all the other path factors come together as one. So samadhi is defined as the cittase kagata, as the unification of mind, which I'll talk a little bit more about later on. So if we want to practice the Eightfold Path, this is the culmination of the path, the outcome, the direct outcome of practicing right mindfulness. So what we've been doing on this retreat, we've been trying to be mindful, mindful of our postures, mindful of our thoughts, mindful of our emotions. And in the meditation, we're mindful of metta or mindful of the other meditation objects that we're doing. And if we practice that right mindfulness well, then it leads to the outcome of right samadhi. Which is the four jhanas. Now, each of these jhanas is defined by the presence and the absence of certain mental factors. And I think it's important to note that this is one of the great innovations that the Buddha introduced into spiritual life and into meditation life. Prior to the Buddha, there had, of course, been a rich contemplative tradition in India. But what you don't find is any sort of clear descriptions of different states of meditation. It seems that the yogis were practicing and were meditating, but they'd always kind of describe their meditation in some kind of mystical sense of union with Brahma or something like that. So it's quite difficult to figure out exactly what they were doing. And it seems that this was one of the breakthroughs which the Buddha introduced, was the ability to be able to clearly describe meditation purely in terms of the actual mental factors present or the mental factors that are absent. In other words, it's a purely empirical and psychological description of states of meditation, and in that respect clearly lays the foundation for the modern psychological study of states of meditation. The advantage of presenting meditation in this way is that we have a clear guide, or at least a relatively more clear guide, as to what we should be doing, what we should be developing. And so an understanding of what jhana is, what the path to jhana is, how to realize it, helps to orient us, it helps to give us some direction, some focus, and it helps us to understand if and when things go wrong. And it also helps us to not be afraid or confused or disturbed when things happen to us in our meditation, because we understand what the path is. So, as I said, each of the four jhanas is defined by the presence and absence of certain mental factors, and I won't have time this evening to go into all of those four jhanas in detail, but I'll just talk about what's most important for the sake of development, and that's the factors of the first jhana. The first jhana has five factors: vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata. And it's defined by also the absence of the five hindrances. So the five hindrances: sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. And also by the absence of the five senses. So there's no sight, sound, smell, taste, or touch. So the five jhana factors: vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata. Vitaka means, before going on to define each of these factors, first thing to remember about jhana is jhana is a state of higher consciousness, adichitta. It's a transformed state of mind. It's a state which the Buddha praised and exalted in the highest terms. He said that this is the bliss which leads to enlightenment. He said it's the footprint of the Tathagata. He said it's equivalent to Nibbana here and now. So we're talking about the very apex, the very, very highest point to which consciousness can be developed. And so because the state of jhana is a state which is so subtle and so refined, it means that all of the factors, all of the mental qualities which are present in jhana will also be refined. So that means that we have to use the ordinary terminology. We have to use ordinary words to describe these things, but those words take on new meanings in the context of jhana. And this applies to all of the terminology we're using to describe higher states of meditation. So the word vitaka, meaning in ordinary language, everyday usage, means thought. In jhana, it doesn't mean thought. And anybody who's meditated even to a little bit of concentration will realize that actually the mind can let go of thinking relatively easily, but that doesn't mean that you've entered any kind of profound state of concentration. So as long as the mind's still thinking, the mind still has many objects, it's still moving, it's still changing, and this isn't a state of mind which is worthy of the title of being called samadhi. So vitaka in the first jhana has a different meaning, and that different meaning is something like the application of the mind. Application. So when we think about something, when we direct our thought to something, we like apply our mind to that object or that topic. Yeah, that's what we do when you think about it, isn't it? You literally apply your mind to that topic. The same thing, jhana has that same characteristic of applying the mind, but it's not verbal, it's not a linguistic thing. It's just a bringing the presence of attention towards the object of the meditation. This is vitakka. The second jhana factor is vichara. Again, in ordinary language, vichara, in ordinary consciousness, vichara means to... it has a kind of more extended meaning than vitakka. It means more like to ponder something, to reflect over something, to explore something. So in jhana, it also... while it has a slightly, doesn't have the same meaning of to reflection or ponder over something, but it still has that extended meaning, and so it means more like the maintaining of the mind or the sustaining of the mind on a particular object. So vitakka, lifting the mind onto an object, vichara, keeping it there, sustaining it there. In the Abhidhamma, it's defined as anusandhanata or anupekhanata. Anusandhanata literally means sustained application. Anupekhanata means sustained observation. So this is what vichara means as a jhana factor. Vitakka, lifting the mind onto the object. Vichara, keeping it there, maintaining, sustaining it there. The third factor, piti, is rapture. And piti is a sense of uplift. Piti, again, in ordinary language, ordinary consciousness, has a meaning of like excitement. Okay, and you can have a sort of sense of excitement over anything, you know, getting something that you want, you know, opening a birthday present or something like that. You have piti, you have that rapture. This is ordinary language usage of rapture. In the context of samadhi, rapture has a much more subtle meaning of a kind of pleasure, which is an uplift, but it's an emotional quality. It's an emotional response to the meditation. Okay. Now, piti in meditation, and as it's considered in the Theravadan tradition, has a very wide variety of applications. So it can refer to a very great number of kinds of experiences. And having spoken with many of the people in the interviews, I know that many people on the retreat have experienced many of the different kinds of piti or rapture in their meditation. You have minor forms of rapture, like the hair rising up on your skin, or a feeling of like a thrill, a sort of electricity or tingle in the spine. And sometimes it'll well up like overwhelming feeling of joy, and tears will flow. So these are all different manifestations of rapture in one form or another. They have the common characteristic of having a positive emotional response to your meditation. This is what makes them piti. That's the common characteristic. Rapture is a positive emotional response to the meditation. However, none of those forms of rapture are the profound form or the subtle form, which is what we're looking for. And what we're looking for is what's called parana piti, is pervasive rapture. And parana piti has a quality of filling the whole body and of uplifting the whole body. It's much more tranquil, it's much more sustained, it's much more even. That's parana piti. But it always has that slight sense of uplift. Next jhana factor, sukha, means pleasure or bliss or happiness. In the context of jhana, perhaps bliss is the best translation. But again, sukha is used very generally in ordinary states of mind. Sukha means the pleasure from eating an ice cream, or the pleasure of having sex, or the pleasure of whatever, taking drugs or having a new car or anything like that can be considered sukha. And obviously, it doesn't mean those same things in the context of jhana. In the context of jhana, sukha has a very, very refined meaning. And sukha is very close in meaning to another word, pasadhi, which means tranquility, settledness. So sukha is that kind of settled aspect of pleasure. It's very calming. It has an integrative quality. So whereas rapture has a more exciting, more uplifting quality. Rapture is the one that dispels boredom. Yeah? Rapture dispels boredom. It makes interest and enthusiasm. Whereas sukha dispels restlessness. Sukha brings us in and contents us, makes us calm, makes us settle down. If you're drinking a glass of champagne, then the rapture is the fizz and the sukha is the sweetness. So you can go and test that afterwards if you like, see whether that works. I wasn't always a monk, you know. So both of these aspects have to be there. Both of them have to be present. And they have to be in balance. Okay? If you have too much sukha, too much on the tranquility side, then you'll tend to go to sleep. Yeah? So then the rapture is the one that then lifts you up and keeps you energized. On the other hand, if there's too much rapture, then the mind will stay be too scattered or too vibrant to be very tranquil. The last factor is ekagata, which means unification. Now, ekagata is often translated as one-pointedness, which is a very misleading translation and one which I'll try to avoid, or sometimes I find myself lapsing into it by force of habit. If I do, please pull me up on it. Unification, I think, is a much better translation. And the problem is, of course, one-pointedness brings us back to this idea of, you know, meditations about sort of cramming everything into one little bit. You sort of have to force yourself to all be in that bit. That's not what one-pointedness means at all. And we know that very clearly from all the descriptions of samadhi, you know, is exalted, expanded, made great, measureless. So we're clearly not talking something which is a point here. So what ekagata means, I think ekagata has three important aspects to it, all of which are implied in the usage of the word ekagata. The first aspect is it means unification of consciousness. That means that there's only one form of consciousness, that is mind consciousness. So no sight, sound, smell, taste or touch. And this is what's implied in the opening of the jhana formula when it says viviceva kamehi, quite secluded from the senses. Okay, so sight, sound, smell, taste and touch are gone. Only mind consciousness, so that's one-pointedness of consciousness. The second aspect of it is one-pointedness in time. And that means that it's not only just mind consciousness, but that mind consciousness is only aware of one thing. Okay, it's only aware of the object of that jhana, which is the nimitta. I'll talk more about that later. So one-pointedness in time. During the period of the jhana, the mind doesn't change its object. In fact, the mind doesn't really change at all during that period. Okay, so one-pointedness in time. And it's because of that one-pointedness in time that meditation experiences, especially deep meditation experiences, are often considered to be glimpses of eternity. And in a way they are. They're a glimpse at a space of consciousness where there is time simply doesn't exist. Actually, according to Buddhism, time isn't something that exists objectively in the world. Time is something that we infer because of the changes of consciousness. our mind changes, what we're aware of changes, how we what we know changes, and because that happens in a somewhat regular manner, we infer, we create the notion of time in order to bring a regularity to that. But in that experience of jhana, that doesn't happen anymore. There's no time. Time stops. It's suspended for a period. So there's one-pointedness in time. And the third aspect of... I said it, one-pointedness. You didn't catch me. You've been doing it all the time, have I? Well, you should be quicker. I've been testing you, all right? And unification, I've been trying to get out of this habit for ages, and I just can't seem to drop it. Maybe I need to go to a 12-step program or something. Okay, and the last one is unification in the sense of balance. And so that means that all of the factors which are present, all of the jhana factors, the vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata, the application of mind, sustaining of mind, the uplift and rapture, the bliss and pleasure, and the unification are all present. They're all in the right amount. They're all in balance. They're all working together in harmony. So this is the unification as balance and harmony. So I think that this is what ekagata means, all these three things. Unification of consciousness, unification in time, and unification in terms of balance. Those three things. So these are the five jhana factors. And these are five qualities which need to be present for the mind to reach a deep state of concentration, for the mind to overcome fully the hindrances, and to fulfill this factor of right samadhi of the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's important to understand this, to recognize, for example, that we need to have rapture and bliss has to be there for our mind to reach deep concentration. There's a lot of approaches to meditation which are based on equanimity and developing just equanimous mindfulness with just based on a neutral feeling. And of course, they're very good meditations. I've taught those meditations during this retreat, and they're something that everyone should do. However, just by practicing those meditations alone, you won't reach that deep concentration and you won't fulfill that factor of right samadhi of the Eightfold Path. So whether you like it or not, you're just going to have to grit your teeth and develop some rapture and bliss, okay? So vitaka, application, vichara, sustaining, piti, uplift, sukha, pleasure, ekagata, unification. Now all of those we've been developing through the metta meditation method, and what I'm going to do now is explain how metta meditation develops each one of those factors. Now I'm only going to do this in the context of the metta meditation as I've been teaching it. Of course, you can do a similar analysis for any kind of meditation, right? So, but I don't have time to do that, but you can take that and apply that to any different kind of meditation. So, remember back to when we started doing the metta meditation, the first thing I said was we're saying the words, may I be happy, and we're saying those words to ourselves clearly and distinctly, yeah? And we're applying our mind to that. So this is developing this factor of vitaka. At this stage, which is right at the beginning of the meditation, the vitaka still, obviously, is a thought in a sense. So it's a much more refined use of thought rather than just thinking randomly about things. We've focused the thought just to one, okay? And that's a very kind of clear and concentrated way of using thought to start with. And so far, that verbal or that linguistic use of thought has continued so far to each stage of the meditation I've talked about in the metta meditation. That's a characteristic of metta meditation. Other meditations, maybe not. Say if you're doing breath meditation or something, you might not use thought in the meditation so much. Again, these are just the different characteristics of different meditations. Of course, in any meditation, including metta, we'll have to leave that thinking behind eventually. And the vitakka will become purely just that applying of the mind. But for most of the meditation up to where we've got so far, we're using the thought, may I be happy, to develop that jhana factor of vitakka, which is applying the mind, applying the mind, applying the mind continually on that object. So this is the vitakka. The vichara is the evenness of that. And it's also when I ask you to reflect on the meaning of the words, yeah? Meaning is something that emerges, like vichara has a literal meaning of exploring. Okay, so meaning is something that emerges when we explore something. So vichara is that sustaining, that keeping, the evenness of it. Okay, when we're saying those words, is the evenness of it. The applying the mind, the clarity, the distinctness of it is the vichara. The evenness, the sustaining of it is the vichara. So those two things working together. And so this is why I've emphasized from the beginning of developing these factors like this. Because if metta meditation is developed without having a sound basis in these factors, what tends to happen is that when the feeling of metta arises, that it tends not to have the solidity and the stability that it needs to develop deep concentration. Okay, so it tends to be more vague. So that using the vitakka vichara in a very careful, very deliberate way at the beginning makes the mind much more solid, much more stable later on. So the next phase that we're developing in the course of the meditation was looking for what is that feeling? What is that feeling like? And we feel that, often you feel it like it's kind of welling up inside the body. And that welling up nature is the rapture. And many people have said to me that they've had tears coming in their eyes, or they feel the hairs up rising up, or these kinds of experiences. So this is all that piti. Again, piti is the positive emotional response to the meditation. So it's that sense of uplift, that slight thrill, that slight excitement that we're coming to in the meditation. Together with that piti, accompanying the piti is also it should be obvious, but in case it's not obvious, when I'm saying piti is a Pali word, piti, Sanskrit is priti. It's not obviously not the English word piti. So accompanying that piti is always some sukha, always a feeling of pleasure. When the piti, or when the rapture initially arises, often that thrill or that exciting sense of the rapture tends to overpower the sukha. Yeah, so that tends to predominate, and the sukha, the pleasure, the bliss, the settling aspect of it is secondary. And as we continue and we deepen the meditation, especially as we're soaking that feeling through the whole body and bringing the whole body that sense of pleasure, then we're balancing, we're equalizing the rapture and the bliss. Okay, so we're bringing those two things gradually into equalization. So if we practice like that, then by the time we finish the first stage of metta, we have those jhana factors present, at least to some extent. They're all established there. And so for the rest of the meditation, it's a matter of continuing to deepen and deepen them. You remember when I spoke earlier, I said if you develop the first stage of metta, when the feeling of metta is clearly established through your whole body, and that all of those factors are there, the mind feels good and is proceeding, and it kind of has a sense of settling into that meditation through metta in the whole body. And if that lasts for a reasonable amount of time, 10 to 20 minutes or so, then this is what we call the first stage of samadhi, called kanika samadhi, or momentary concentration. And the feeling of metta at that time, we call, the technical word for it is the uggaha nimitta, the preliminary or the learning sign. Okay, so that's in the first stage of metta meditation. So as you continue through the second stage and the third stage, that experience will gradually, bit by bit, will deepen and deepen and become stronger and become stronger until we reach the fourth stage of loving kindness for the disliked person, which I'll come on to now. So for the disliked person, similarly with the loved person and the neutral person, is you want to choose somebody a little bit carefully. You want to choose somebody who, you know, you find annoying or who gets on your nerves. It doesn't have to be like a mortal enemy or a nemesis or anything like that. Just someone you find, you know, when you think about them, you tend to have negative thoughts or critical thoughts or something. It's important when you're choosing your disliked person to just choose them very quickly and then stop thinking about them. Because otherwise you might not get going at all. And make sure that you have that person clearly in your mind before you start the meditation. So by the time you get to the fourth person, you're not sitting there thinking, who do I dislike? I like this, but no, I dislike, I like, I really hate them more. Should I do, I should do them. And okay, so that's going to mess you up pretty quickly. So make sure it's clear in your mind beforehand. Now when you come to that fourth person, the fourth stage is going to be by far the most difficult and challenging, but also the most rewarding and most powerful of these stages. When we reach that fourth stage, if we've developed properly through the first, second and third stage, our mind is already quite powerful, quite clear. Hindrances are quite low, they're not completely disappeared, but the hindrances are quite quiet. And we should feel good about coming in and developing metta for that fourth person. Now, at that stage, what happens is that the mind, in a way, leaps out towards the meditation. It's as if there's an innate recognition, like an intuition, that your mind knows this is what I have to do. This is my task. I don't have any kind of lingering doubts or uncertainties kind of drop away, and the mind automatically comes into this kind of focus. Yes, this is what I really need to do. I've been practicing, I've been meditating, I've been doing my spiritual practices for so long, and somehow there's this inherent knowledge in that actually I've still been nursing this hatred and this enmity in my heart. And somehow this is a blockage, this is an obstacle for me, and if only I could overcome that. And so there's this tremendous, usually a tremendous energy comes. So compared to, say, the third stage, where often, as I said, often the energy tends to slacken off in the third stage because we don't really care about the person, then in the fourth stage, it tends to be the opposite. The mind is filled with a very powerful energy, kind of a resolute determination. It's not that you do that, it just comes naturally. Sorry? Okay, that's good. Excellent. Of course, then the problem will be that the mind is very tricky, and your mind wants to subvert all of that good work that you're doing. And so what you often find in that fourth stage is you're doing metta for that fourth person. May they be happy, and it's all going good. And then you allow yourself to think about that person a little bit, but only good thoughts. May they be happy. Oh, they really are a good person after all. May they be happy. They really are a good person. They're not nearly as much of a complete bastard as I thought they were. May they be happy. Well, yeah, okay, sometimes they're a complete bastard. But they weren't like all the time. May they be happy. And then before you know it, the mind has, and it's astonishing, the mind has become so powerful, there's so much energy, that your mind can rip itself out of the metta very fast and into kind of a raging fury of hatred and vengeance. Okay, so make sure if you're doing this stage, don't keep any sharp weapons nearby. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not all that much. There is a strong sense in which that the mind can flip very fast at this stage. So you need very, very strong mindfulness. Okay, very strong. Don't let the mind waver at all. Don't let the mind go off into thinking about that person or thinking about anything else. Keep on that focus right in the center. Keep at that time. Your feeling of metta will become stronger. The light in the heart becomes stronger. All that time we've been focusing on bringing the mind into the body. Now, because the one-pointedness is becoming strong, we now realize we only have one target, one thing left to do, one goal. And so the unification becomes stronger, 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 stronger. And the awareness of the five senses starts to fade away. And your mind will start to withdraw from seeing. It'll start to withdraw from hearing. And it'll start to withdraw from being aware of any sensations in the body. They're still there, but you're not paying attention to them anymore. Yeah. And of course, that stage of meditation can be very delicate. Yeah, because you're almost completely withdrawn, for example, from hearing. But then if something happens and then that sound breaks through, it can be very startling. You can really kind of jump. Yeah? So this stage of meditation becomes very, very delicate. And so you're keeping on coming back to that may that disliked one be happy, may they be happy. And the mind kind of keeps on pursuing that and keeps on getting deeper and deeper as all of those five jhana factors are present. Now, as that continues, what you'll find is that the sense of rapture and bliss or the sense of light associated with the nimitta of metta gradually becomes more powerful. Now, the nimitta itself, nimitta just means sign, and so the nimitta is just the mind's reflection of its own state of purity and concentration at that point. It's not anything else, it's not anything that exists objectively, it's just one's own perception of that mind, that awareness as it's becoming purified. And so the nimitta can appear in different ways. The appearance of the nimitta is not important. So, for example, it can appear as a light. It could be, for some people, it's more just a vague sense of brightness, or it can be like a light like the sun, or it can be different colours and so on. That appearance of it is not important. And similarly, in metta meditation, the metta nimitta is mostly the feeling of metta, which by now has become very powerful, very pervasive, very stable. And yet, even though it's primarily a feeling, it also has a light to it. If you want to, you can shift your perception and just see it as a light, or you can see it as a feeling. It doesn't really matter. It's just two aspects of the same experience. What often happens at this stage of meditation is that the mind will go along, it will kind of drop down and become to a greater level of peacefulness. It will kind of drop down at one point. And when it goes to a new level of peacefulness, then you get a bit excited about it. Yeah, we talked about doing a jig the other night. So you kind of go along and you go down and then, ooh, this is a bit exciting. So then it kind of comes up a bit more. It goes on, stabilizes a bit, and then drops down again and then does another bit of a jig. And then, and that process can go on for quite some time, yeah. And this particular stage of meditation can last for a long time if you're practicing in this way. Normally, it would take you maybe, you know, an hour or something to reach that stage, and then you stay on that fourth stage for somebody who's developing the practice, and stay on the fourth stage for usually up to another hour, another 2 hours after that. But it's not something to force or to kind of push yourself. It just happens because the mind just has that energy, and it just wants to keep on practicing. It wants to keep on meditating. It wants to stay there with that meditation object. Now, at a certain point, the mind does another one of these things. It kind of drops down, but it does so with much more stability, and then the more refined nimitta of metta arises. Okay, so in the classical Theravadin description of this practice, you have two nimittas, the preliminary nimittas, the ugaha nimitta, and the ugaha nimitta can be quite varied, can manifest in many different ways, and it's not particularly stable. And then there's what they call the patibhaga nimitta, the reflex sign, which arises and is completely purified and very powerful and very stable. So at a certain point, while you're developing that fourth stage, the mind will drop down and the patibhaga nimitta will arise. And the patibhaga nimitta will be, first time you experience it, it will be the most powerful experience you've ever had in your life. It arises in your mind with the power like the sun. And you'll understand why meditators, if they're practicing in a theistic tradition, would say, "This is God. I've seen the face of God." Because the power of this thing is so overwhelming, and it's like it pushes anything else out of the mind. The mind just becomes overwhelmingly filled with this presence of light, of love, and of bliss, as such that nothing else can almost find its way in. So this is what we call the patibhaga nimitta, the reflex sign, and that state of concentration, that state of meditation, we call upachara samadhi. Now the word upachara is translated in a number of different ways. They're sometimes translated as access concentration or neighborhood concentration, but I don't think those translations are adequate. If you talk about access, for example, the access to this building is the road that comes up here from Kingsbury Drive. This is the access. Or if you talk about neighborhood, you say, well, Bodhinyana Monastery is in our neighborhood. It's like a kilometer down the road. That's not what upachara means. Upachara is actually another one of these words which has an ordinary everyday usage, and in building, upachara means the front porch. Okay, so the upachara for this room is that little access room out there. That's the upachara. It's not the road that goes down to the front of the monastery. That's not the upachara. The upachara is that room right there. So that state of upachara samadhi, so I prefer the translation threshold rather than neighborhood or access, threshold concentration. It means you're right there on the threshold, and it's literally only a step or two away from getting into jhana. So at that point, the mind is very pure, it's very powerful, it's very concentrated. And yet, the one of the most amazing things about that state of mind is that even though it's so powerful, that it feels so normal. It's the most normal state of mind that you've ever experienced. It feels like finally, things work as they should do. Finally, it feels like coming home. It feels like, well, this is actually where I've belonged all along. And it feels almost as if you could just forget the meditation, get up and go and do anything you liked, and the mind would just stay like that, because it's the most natural thing in the world. So it's this kind of almost paradoxical nature. So this state of upachara samadhi is still not quite the state of jhana. The mind's still not quite completely unified yet. It's still possible to think, although you kind of wouldn't, but it's still possible to hear. And again, normally you kind of wouldn't hear, but you might. So mind, this is kind of in-between thing. You're almost there, but just not quite. So if, and here at this point is slightly different between metta meditation and breath meditation. If you're doing breath meditation at this point, you just don't do anything. You just completely let go and just be with the nimitta, don't do anything from there on. In metta meditation, you've still got a little bit to do. And what we do at that point when that nimitta has arisen is that's where we start spreading metta out to all beings. And that's where we start to move the metta outside of the body for the first time. And you can do that in stages, gradually spreading metta to all beings in the room, in the building, in the place, in the district, in the state, in the country, and then to the world. So we're gradually moving the mind out. But as we're doing that, this is not like thinking, and it's not like moving your mind, you know, to all of that kind of space. What it is just like you're allowing your consciousness to expand. That's all. You're consciously bringing out the mind, the sense of awareness, out stage by stage, letting it expand. And for the first time, the mind really has the energy and the strength to really do that. And you realize this is what the Buddha was talking about when he was talking about having a mind of loving kindness for all beings and spreading that over the whole world. And you're actually doing that. You feel your consciousness spreading out. It's a total spin out. And eventually you just let go and let the mind go. And from that, and that point, then the same as in anapanasati, you just don't do anything, okay? Ajahn Chah said you don't go forward, you don't go back, and you don't stand still. Yeah? If you go forward, you're pushing. If you go back, you're pulling back. If you're standing still, it gets rigid, gets stuck. So you don't do either of any of those things. You just be. And from that point, there's nothing more that you can do in meditation. There's no, you don't have any conscious control over it, and it's up to the mind. Will go into jhana or it won't. If the conditions are there, then the mind will slip into the jhana. If it's not, then it won't. What sometimes happens is that when the mind goes into jhana for the first time, or not just for the first time, but when it goes in there when it's still not practiced, is that you can feel quite a lot of fear. And so you can actually have a feeling almost of terror. It feels like you're stepping out of one world and stepping into a totally different world. I shouldn't really say it feels like you're stepping out of one world. You are stepping out of one world into a totally different world. It's not like you are. You are stepping into a totally different world. And you've got everything that you've known dies. Everything that you've ever known is left behind there. Every sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, everything is just gone. Your body is gone and the mind goes into that place. And so there's a fear of the unknown. And if that happens, as the mind's pulled in, there's like this kind of gravitational pull, you're kind of sucked in, then fear comes and your heart can start beating. And of course then you sort of step back and you've lost the tranquility, so then you have to sort of wait and then see and maybe come back again. So this can happen a number of times. But finally, when the mind's ready, the mind goes into jhana. The mind becomes completely still, becomes completely peaceful. There's no thinking, there's no senses, there's no volition, no change of the mind. And the mind just rests in that space of bliss and light and peace. And it rests there for as long as it wants to. Later on, when if you develop the skill in that, you can develop the skill of making a prior determination. So you can say, well, I want to get into the jhana for half an hour or something like that. But when you're still learning and you're doing it for the first time, then you just have to let it go for as long as it will. Once it's in there, it's out of your control. So the mind will just stay there. And then when it's ready, it's finished, it'll just withdraw. And the mind which is withdrawn from jhana is still very powerful. The hindrances have been deeply suppressed, and the mind is still very still and very energetic. So that's the mind which is ideal for developing insight, for developing vipassana. And I'm going to talk some more about that tomorrow evening. So for this evening, it's probably enough talk. Let's do some guided meditation. And we'll do meditation up to the fourth person for the disliked one. So just think very quickly of a disliked person. And don't worry if you're not ready for doing that stage yet. You'll know soon enough. And when you start doing the metta for that, you'll feel the anger and the annoyance come, and then you'll know, ha-ha, not ready for that yet. Sitting quietly. Allowing the mind to settle inside the body. Leaving the mind in the heart, say to oneself the words, May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Repeating those words again and again and again. Evenly, steadily. Making a firm foundation for the mind. Letting the feeling of metta well up inside. Letting it soak through and fill up the whole body. Until every cell, every part of the body is soaked through with a beautiful, warm, peaceful feeling of loving kindness. second stage, metta for the loved one. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. Keeping the mind even and steady, grounded and centered in the whole body. metta for the third person, the neutral one. May that neutral one be happy. May that neutral person be happy. May that neutral person be happy. Keeping the mind focused and grounded. Carefully applying the mind to develop loving kindness for that neutral person. Kindness for the disliked person. May that disliked person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. Keeping the mind focused, steady. And taking that same feeling of metta, gradually spreading it outside the body. May all beings in this room be happy. May all beings in this room be happy. May all beings in Jhana Grove be happy. May all beings in Jhana Grove be happy. Gradually letting the sense of awareness, the sphere of awareness, expand outwards. May all beings in Serpentine be happy. May all beings in the Southwest be happy. May all beings in WA be happy. May all beings in Australia be happy. May all beings in the world be happy. May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy. Letting down any boundaries or barriers. Letting the metta flow out, limitless, without end. Then bringing the mind back little by little. May all beings in Australia be happy. May all beings in WA be happy. May all beings in the Southwest be happy. May all beings in Serpentine be happy. Feeling the mind gradually contract, come back in. May all beings in Jhana Grove be happy. May all beings in this room be happy. And then back into one's own body. May that disliked person be happy. May the neutral person be happy. May the loved one be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Letting the words of metta go. Letting the feeling of metta fade away. return to a neutral, empty space. And just taking a minute to review over the meditation. What just happened? How did my mind change? What were those different stages of the meditation like? What was it like doing metta for the disliked person? Did I get any feelings of anger or ill will come up? And what was it like when we spread metta out to all beings? And what's the mind like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Gone and done it, haven't I? I've now mixed up my red ones and my unred ones. So, I think these are the unread ones. I won't read all of these questions this evening, but I'll just have a look at... I'll try to pick out those ones which are more specifically about the metta meditation, and I might leave the more general ones till tomorrow morning. Okay, so just a few questions on specifically on the metta. Okay, first question here. If we're sitting for an hour and the feeling of metta disappears halfway through the sitting, should we keep trying various ways to get the feeling back or switch to another meditation object? It's assuming that you want to complete the hour's session. So, I mean, actually... really, the best way to do it is to just meditate as long as the feeling of metta wants to last. I mean, of course, sometimes it happens that we have a particular amount of time we want to sit for, but really it's kind of better to just let nature guide us. But if the feeling of metta does go and you want to continue meditating, I would say for the most part, I would go back to doing just a mindfulness or vipassana based practice after that. Just be aware of what that feeling is in the body after the metta has gone, and perhaps to do some kind of vipassana contemplation, or else just a mindful awareness contemplation for the rest of the sitting. Second part of the question: when we go down the stages at the end, should we do that slower than the speed we do at the guided session? I feel as if I'm being pulled out of the session too fast. And a bit of a sad face there. So, yeah, sure, just do it at whatever speed that you like. Just to clarify, in the guided meditations, we've been going like from oneself, love, person, and neutral, and so on, and then working our way backwards. So it's best to do it that way each time you sit. So you work through each of the stages on the way up and then each of the stages again on the way down. The purpose of doing that is so that we don't sort of jerk our mind around, or we don't strain the mind by coming out of meditation too quickly. So just adjust that to your own speed, however comfortable you feel coming out. Yes, normally when I do the guided meditations, I do that a little bit quickly because we... not doing the meditation for so long, so I take it out a bit more quickly. But just the idea is that at each stage, as you're coming down, let's say if you've meditated to do metta for the neutral person, and then you want to finish the meditation, then you come from the neutral person, you come to the loved one, and you stay there until you have you're clear and comfortable with that stage. So the metta for the loved one is there, and you feel clearly established on that stage and you feel comfortable about coming down again and then down to oneself. May I be happy. May I be happy. And then stay there until you feel that stage is clear and you're comfortable with that, and then let go of that. So just see your own how you want to go with that. Bhante is metta, also dukkha. Sabbe sankhara dukkha. And thank you for the lovely retreat. Oh, well, thank you for the thank you. Yes, metta is dukkha. Metta is suffering, but it's not quite as much suffering as most other things. Suffering is always relative. Actually, the Buddha said that the whole of the Noble Eightfold Path is still conditioned, so it's still within that realm of suffering, but it's leading out of suffering, and hopefully it's, relatively speaking, at least a much lesser form of suffering. Okay. Okay, so during the metta meditation, do I recommend doing it in cycles? For example, to oneself, then loved one, and then when completed, go through that again, to oneself and loved one again, or just do one cycle for each person for a long time? Generally speaking, not to shift between the people too quickly, so rather slower than faster. Normally when I do it, I just do sort of one cycle, so I just spend the time for myself and then the loved one and the neutral one and so on for as long as I think for those people. But if you want to go up and down a little bit, that's okay, as long as you don't do it too fast, but particularly if you're doing it in response to the conditions in the meditation itself. So, for example, if you come to the third person and you feel your energy is drifting away, and then you bring it back down to the loved one or back to oneself and build the feeling up and then come back again. So if you're doing it for a good reason like that, then that's not a problem. But still try not to do it too much, so you're not sort of moving too quickly around. If second part of the question, if we do meditate in cycles, is it then better to stick with the same people or to change them? So could you have a different loved one on the second cycle? So best to have the same people, okay, in each meditation. From one meditation to the next, you can change them, but in the same meditation, keep it as the same person. Otherwise it becomes too complicated and mind can be confused. You can sort of drift from one to the other or something like that. So best to keep it the same person. Okay, so it's getting a little bit late now, so maybe it's time to finish up, and I'll see you back here tomorrow morning.